From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
Hi, Joyce Vance.
Good morning, Preet. How are you? You were up late last night.
We had this great event with Adam Schiff at the Great Hall at Cooper Union. We had a lovely dinner afterwards. It was good. We talked about a lot of stuff.
I mean, what great timing, right? The Select Committee just issued more subpoenas in the January 6th Committee
investigation. Roger Stone, Alex Jones, among others.
Did you get any inside scoop?
He talked about some of the reasoning that was behind getting those folks. I also pressed him a little bit on the question that you and I have gotten a lot, which is, why doesn't the Congress enforce its own subpoenas instead of deferring to the Justice Department? Because it's an independent decision that the DOJ then has to make.
Yeah.
And the audience was very into that idea that, you know, they used to have a jail back in the 1930s and before that, where someone defied a subpoena, was held in contempt of Congress. Congress itself could take action. It's not up to him. He's on the committee and he's the chair of the Intelligence Committee. But that's something that I think people have a lot of interest in. Now, it can be abused.
I mean, I was going to say, I wonder if people will have that same enthusiasm when House Speaker Trump puts people in that little cell in the back of the house.
I'm not sure the cells should be so little, because I think there's a lot of folks that might, you know, be needed to be put in the dock. You also had a special interview recently.
I did. You were out last week, and so I had a chance to talk with my friend Roger McNamee, who was an early investor in Facebook, but became very disenchanted with some of the decisions that were being made by Mark Zuckerberg. So we had a great conversation about where Facebook is headed and what that means for all of us.
You know what's interesting about my conversation with Adam Schiff last night?
What?
We talked about a lot of things about which people would have strong feelings and strong emotions, including the insurrection and, you know, Trump coming back and the big lie relating to the election of 2020 and all sorts of things. And the audience was fairly well behaved. Then towards the end of the interview, I did a lightning round with Adam Schiff and I asked him the question, should Facebook be broken up? And immediately there's yelling from the audience, yes, yes, break them up, break them up.
Wow.
It's amazing when 45 minutes and they were, you know, relatively quiet but attentive, I mentioned Facebook and people went bananas.
That is very interesting. And so what did Schiff say?
He gave an answer that got at some of the tensions and the issues and the misinformation. I don't think he was very specific one way or the other just yet.
Well, good topic for another day, whether the fact that folks in Congress are of an age where many of them don't understand the internet, if that perhaps led to a failure to legislate and regulate that's in part responsible for where we are.
So today we're going to, I guess, talk about two cases that have gotten the focus of a lot of people in this country. One has concluded, the other one, summations are still going on. They are, of course, the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, and the other is the trial of three men who were involved in the killing of an unarmed black man named Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. You want to talk about Rittenhouse first?
Let's talk about Rittenhouse first.
So let me say a couple of things about this. There's a lot of strong feelings about this case, about the fact that the jury acquitted him on all counts. There's a lot of discussion about the judge. And I think there are a few things that I think we could all agree on, and then we'll get to the specifics about which there's some disagreement. Number one, I was not surprised at the verdict, given how the evidence came in. Were you surprised at the verdict?
I was a little bit surprised because once the prosecution got the provocation instruction that says that you can't take advantage of self-defense if you provoked the incident, I thought the prosecution might get a conviction on maybe one count. What I didn't expect was the acquittal. I thought the jury would hang.
You thought the jury would hang. That's fair. Second point I would make, so we already disagreed about the first thing. The second point I would make is, really, none of the parties covered themselves in glory, neither the judge, nor the prosecution, nor the defense. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I try to not be critical of, you know, battlefield decision-making, right? Because you know, like I know, that as a prosecutor, sometimes words don't come out right or things don't go well. In this case, my feeling was that these were some early decisions that really came home to roost during trial. So no glory anywhere.
And the third point I would make is, the fact that Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted should not make him, in my mind, and there are people who disagree with this, but should not make him, in my mind, any kind of hero and wonderful, amazing paragon of virtue or conduct. And the fact that there are Republican members of Congress who are lionizing him and who have offered him jobs as an intern in their offices, I think is deplorable.
Yeah, it's despicable behavior. For one thing, being acquitted doesn't mean that you're innocent. It just means that you're not guilty in the technical sense that the government failed to provide proof beyond a reasonable doubt that you committed the crimes you're charged with. That's a long way from saying that Kyle Rittenhouse doesn't, for instance, continue to be dangerous. And something that I'm watching carefully is how he behaves following this acquittal. He has, I think, an opportunity here to do good, but it seems clear that he's not interested in taking that opportunity.
So let's talk about why he was acquitted, why it was not totally unreasonable for the jury to acquit, even though you at least thought that given a particular instruction that they were given, there was a possibility of conviction. And the main reason from a sort of 30,000 foot level is that what people don't always appreciate is the law dictates certain things that are different from what common sense tells you, right? So a lot of what this case came down to was a focused concentration on that narrow moment with respect to his shooting three people, and whether in that moment, notwithstanding, to some degree, notwithstanding the decision to come to another state, the decision to be carrying an AR-15, the decision to be in the midst of a lot of violence where lots of bad things can happen, you put yourself in that situation. Much of that, if not all of that, was off the table of consideration, but for the provocation point that you can elaborate on in a moment. And if the law is dictating that you're focusing on, you know, the precise narrow moment that Kyle Rittenhouse pulled the trigger those few times, the defense got to emphasize that with respect to one person, that one person had a gun. With respect to another person, he tried to take Rittenhouse's gun away, his rifle away from him. On the third occasion, one person who he ended up shooting was smashing his neck with a skateboard. And people that have differences of opinion of how dangerous it was and whether or not shooting those people was proportional or not. But those were the facts that the jury was compelled to focus on rather than the whole sort of larger context of why Kyle Rittenhouse was there. Is that fair?
I think that's fair, and it's a really interesting question because I suspect you agree with this. The outcome of this case would have likely been different if the jury had been exposed to what I'll just call the whole ball of wax, right? The decision that Rittenhouse makes to come over and that entire context. If that had been part of the calculus for determining provocation, this could have been a different case. But as you say, the law imposes constraints. The judge instructs the jury on the law, and the jury's obligation is to follow the law as the judge gives it to them.
I have another question for you. So obviously the prosecution is disappointed in, I'm guessing, every case where there's an acquittal, if they spend the time and resources and exercise their discretion to charge a human being with a crime or multiple crimes, they believe that the case is righteous and just, and they want a conviction. When you had acquittals in your office, when you were the U.S. attorney, did you put out statements after acquittals?
I don't think I ever put out a formal statement. Also, I didn't really get acquittals when I was a U.S. attorney.
You never got any acquittal ever? You know what they say about
no,
that.
We
you
did.
Weren't trying hard.
Okay. We did. In fact, you know, in civil rights cases, we had a dangerous record of hanging juries, but that's a topic for another day. I think what you say when there's an acquittal, and I'm sure that I always said this in substance, is our job is to present the evidence to the jury, and it's up to the jury to decide the case. And as long as we present our evidence to the jury, then justice has been done.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I said that, but we would put out a statement if it was a case of public significance and public interest and include a line where we say, you know, we respect the jury's decision. You don't trash the jury, you don't complain about the jury, you don't complain about the judge, and you learn whatever lessons are supposed to be learned, and then you move on to the next case.
You know, and I think it's worth saying this. We're observing these trials. And for instance, in Rittenhouse, I watched a significant portion of the trial. I didn't watch every last witness. I didn't get to sort of look them in the eye in the way that the jury does. And I have tremendous respect for groups of jurors to reach decisions when they deliberate based on the evidence. What's impressive to me in this case is that this was a unanimous acquittal. even if there was dispute in the jury room, we don't really know how those deliberations went, the jurors ultimately were able to vote and reach a unanimous verdict. And that seems to suggest to me that there really were flaws in the government's evidence. And so I'm very hesitant to criticize that jury verdict, despite what I might have seen in the case.
There was a great piece in the Washington Post by Philip Bump, and I think it's worth quoting from at a little bit of length, that relates to what we've just been talking about. And he writes, with respect to the Rittenhouse case, quote, "It's important to step back from the Rittenhouse verdict and contextualize it. Rittenhouse killed two people, and the state was unable to convince a jury that he bore criminal responsibility for doing so." And then he makes it a point to say what the jury was and was not considering. And he writes, "The jury was not asked whether it approved of Rittenhouse's actions or if individuals should take it upon themselves to supplement or replace law enforcement. They were not asked to take sides in the underlying tension between critics of law enforcement behavior and the police. Perhaps other jurors would have reached a different conclusion." And then he says, "The problem here is not the jury. The problem is one that predates August 25 of last year, a willingness to leverage violence for political ends and to rationalize political violence," end quote. What do you think of that?
It's something that, you know, you and I have talked about a little bit, this notion of vigilantism becoming a feature of society. I think that there's a lot of truth to that and a lot of concern. The reason I'm hedging a little bit here is I don't like the notion of letting Kyle Rittenhouse avoid specific responsibility and accountability for his own conduct. Yes, you know, we live with a certain zeitgeist, but what Rittenhouse did was a series of specific decisions that he himself made. And ultimately, I think that that's what the jury should have honed in on. And perhaps they did so and you know, properly just said there's not enough evidence here to convict.
It reminds me a little bit of some of these unfortunate police officer shootings of unarmed black men, insofar as you have a circumstance in which, and there are a lot of cases like this, where a bunch of mistakes are made, bad judgments are made. So, for example, you know, cops go to a residence based on a flawed search warrant. You know, they don't, this is some of the stuff that happened in the Breonna Taylor case, and they make mistake after mistake. But then the law causes a jury or prosecutors to focus on the very, very narrow moment of the cop feeling like he was threatened and they can use deadly force. And in no way does that justify the whole act. And in no way is that, you know, justice in the larger sense, depending on the circumstances. But the law is very focused on that moment. And I think that's what happened here. The evidence of the decisions that Kyle Rittenhouse made, the person who gave him the AR-15 made, that his mother made and other people made, those were mentioned. And there was some about a color given. But the precise jury instructions were about mostly whether in the moment, you know, whatever circumstances led him to be there and however poor judgment it was for him to be there. As I understand the law in Wisconsin and the law was given to the jurors, what was more relevant and more important to the decision of the case was, for example, when someone pointed a gun at Kyle Rittenhouse, did he have a reasonable fear that he was in mortal danger, which permitted him to shoot?
Yeah, it's that pinpoint moment. And something that's been, I think, tough in watching this trial is not being able to see the jurors and not knowing what their reactions to evidence have been. That's something that I always focused on a lot as a prosecutor. It helped me decide what I wanted to emphasize in closing argument, for instance. And we didn't have that here. But I suspect that although really, if you think about it analytically, the key moment in what happens here is this first shooting. It's the first time that Kyle Rittenhouse pulls the trigger and everything sort of flows from there. I suspect that what was very influential with the jury was hearing the testimony of Gage Grosskreutz.
"It wasn't until you pointed your gun at him, advanced on him, with your gun, now your hands down, pointed at him, that he fired, right?"
"Correct."
I suspect that that had a lot of impact, sort of an outsized impact on the jury.
Oh, yeah. And especially it does when it's a witness that you're expecting to hear be helpful to the prosecution. And when a witness that the prosecution calls with great expectation that that person is going to help prove guilt and does the opposite, that's a devastating setback to the prosecution. So the law limited the ways in which the jury could think about the case, whether that's good or bad. People can you know, make up their own minds. But also the way the case came in. That's the phrase that we use as trial lawyers, and how'd the case come in? And sometimes it doesn't come in the way it does in the storyboards that you plan out in your mind. And some of your witnesses, and some of the witnesses in this case, like the one you just described, actually ended up being good for the defense. And there was another witness also, right? There was a journalist who talked about what his observations were with respect to another victim. And we'll talk about the victim issue in a moment too, who was, you know, chasing at Kyle Rittenhouse and attempted to grab his rifle. You know, so Rittenhouse's testimony about the threat he faced then, whether he should have been in that position or not, is a separate matter. But the testimony that he gave about feeling he was under threat when someone lunged at him, tried to grab his rifle, is corroborated by a third-party witness. That was also harmful to the prosecution's case.
You know, it was. And again, the government always bears the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt in these cases. And I've wondered if in this era where there's available video of crimes, if the burden on the government doesn't become even heavier, because jurors are in some ways expecting to see the government's version of the crime on videotape. And here the videotape is at best equivocal, it's grainy, it's certainly susceptible of the self-defense argument that Rittenhouse wants to make. And I think the failure of the videotape to clearly back up the government's arguments is something else that puts them behind the eight ball in this prosecution.
But, you know, as Philip Bump says, there's a way of looking at the case. It's not just purely about the narrow moment and the legal instructions and what the legal responsibility and decision-making of the jury is, but for society and for the country at large that is undergoing a period of, you know, deep concern about violence and about the way in which protests should be done and the way in which counter-protesting should be done. You know, there seems to be an increasing interest in vigilanteism. I mean, Ahmaud Arbery, that case we're going to talk about in a moment, is a little bit about vigilanteism. Even the Texas abortion case, about which we're going to get a decision any moment, is a little bit of a vigilante type situation also, because it empowers private citizens, not through violence, but through bringing lawsuits, empowering them to oppose abortion and call out fellow citizens. There seems to be this trend in some quarters for private citizens to be deputized and do the work of law enforcement, either because they think law enforcement is not doing what they're supposed to be doing or because they think it's fun to do. I don't know. What do you think about that?
You know, I think this is private citizens deputizing themselves because they don't like the way the world works. And maybe they don't like the fact that the police were restrained that night, that the police didn't shoot anyone. There's a little bit of irony here where Tucker Carlson makes the argument that the police failed to respond and so Rittenhouse had to do their job for them. And you sort of stop and think, well, yeah, Rittenhouse did go out and shoot people. Maybe that's what some folks wanted to see in reaction to the Black Lives Matter protests. But this is the fatal undermining of the rule of law in this country when we return to the era of vigilanteism instead of the era where we all get along, we all work together because we have certain rules. And maybe we don't like the application of a rule in a specific instance, but we understand that it's those rules that permit us to function. We are losing that shared set of assumptions.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. We talk on the show from time to time about the perception that police officers are not trained well enough in restraint or in de-escalating or whatever the case may be. And that's certainly true. We see case after case that involves, you know, that scenario. But I got to tell you, you know, your average police officer, law enforcement agent is a hell of a lot better trained and restrained than your average 17-year-old with an AR-15. Or, you know, three white men, one of whom was a former cop in Georgia, thinking that it's, you know, taking the law into their own hands with respect to Ahmaud Arbery. If you think the police are bad, just wait till the public citizenry starts acting like they're the police.
There is no police chief, no sheriff who wants Kyle Rittenhouse out helping his department do their job on a night like the night that Carl Rittenhouse shot and killed two men. They all want him to stay off the streets, right? Every last one.
Yeah, and he should have stayed off the streets. When you're showing up with an AR-15 in the middle of violence and you're 17 years old, it's not going to end well. Now, here's another point that some people are making, and I wonder if you find this disturbing. I don't think this came out in the trial. It wouldn't be relevant at trial, and it's not legally relevant in any case. There are some people on the right who are lionizing Rittenhouse in part because of the criminal backgrounds of some of the people that he shot. And, you know, one of them, I think, was a convicted child sex offender, I think multiple times, which is a terrible thing. Is that legally relevant in this case?
Well, isn't that your vision of America, Preet? I mean, you can take your AK-47 and go kill anyone who has a prior criminal conviction if you don't, you know, like them or if you feel threatened by them. I mean, I don't mean to make light of it. If people have prior criminal history, and in that one case, the prior criminal history was for some pretty heinous crimes, those folks need to face accountability in the context of the criminal justice system. And Kyle Rittenhouse didn't know that night. And even if he had known, it would not have been relevant. He's not judge, jury, and executioner. That's emphatically not how our system works.
So we're talking about the judge a little bit. I talked about him a little bit last week. My view is the judge was not good, did not have a good tone, seemed to indicate, whether he was biased or not, seemed to indicate a bias against the prosecution. But, as I think you and I have discussed on a prior occasion, some of the decisions, even though they were delivered in a caustic way that might have caused the jury to have the perception that, you know, the prosecution was not to be trusted or was to be, you know, disbelieved to some degree and lost some of their credibility. Some of his decisions, let's talk about the ones that were, I think, correct. I think I've heard you say this. On the issue of when he got mad at the prosecution for making comment on the silence of Rittenhouse post-arrest, that was a no-no. That's a taboo. And the prosecution was rightfully admonished for that, correct?
I think that's right. The prosecution stepped over the line there. The judge would have been well within his rights to grant a mistrial for that.
And then on another occasion, the prosecution tried to bring in something that the court either had ruled shouldn't come in or had not definitively ruled. That also is the basis for criticism, right?
It is. And the court had actually made a pretrial ruling that the evidence could not come in. And here's what you know as a lawyer in that situation. Before you even raise a whisper of a mention of that evidence in front of the jury, you ask the judge if you can approach the bench. You take the other lawyer along and you say, "Judge, I believe the defense has opened the door and I'd like to get into this topic. Will you please revisit your earlier ruling?" None of that happened here. And that was clearly objectionable. And frankly, I have heard judges be angrier than this judge was. So I'm willing to spot him that sort of early, he was, let's just say, mercurial.
Yes. Now, here's another one on which there seems to be a lot of difference of opinion, including among friends of ours. In my experience, and in other people's experience, at least in SDNY federal court, and I'm very curious to know what your experience has been, it has never been an issue in a case of this nature for the prosecutors to refer to the deceased people as victims, especially in a case where, you know, the whole case turns upon self-defense, but there's no question that these people were killed, that they were shot by an AR-15, and they were in fact killed by the defendant. So just as a general matter of English, they are victims. Was their shooting something that requires legally the prosecution and conviction of the shooter? Well, that's the issue, you know, that's central to the case. But in my experience, it wouldn't have been any issue to call them victims. Some defense lawyers have told me that that's a common motion that is made, depending on the circumstances, and that in some state courts, including in Wisconsin, it's not crazy because you're sort of prejudging it. My view is, even if that's so, the prosecution is obviously saying a lot of things that are about the ultimate question in the case. The prosecution is literally getting up there and saying that this person is guilty of murder, which is the ultimate question that needs to be decided. And so the added prejudice of saying these people were victims doesn't really seem to mean a lot. But some defense lawyers have said it's not crazy. What do you think?
So I was not particularly worried by this. This is this particular judge's long-term practice to disallow the use of the word victim. I think it actually, in Earth 2, where there was a conviction in this case and it went up on appeal, it would have looked very fishy if he had just out of the blue permitted the use of the word victim in this case when it was his practice not to. And, you know, if I'm the prosecution, I'm going to say, okay, judge, that's fine. I won't say victim. Every time I refer to them, I'll say the people that the defendant shot and killed. right? Because that's a factually accurate description of what happened. So I'm not really worried by this.
But did this issue ever come up in Alabama? Did you prosecutors say victims?
In federal court, I never had a judge say that we couldn't use the word victim. I suspect in state court in Alabama, this is a live issue.
It's interesting. I mean, I tried to conjure up another example where the ruling makes even more sense. I gave the example on Stay Tuned last week, and I imagined a case in which a husband is criminally charged with the murder of his wife by poison. And the defense is that the wife died of natural causes, some, you know, medical condition that she had. In that case, calling the wife a victim seems premature, arguably, right? It's a better argument.
That's a really good example.
Right, because the wife wasn't shot. The whole question at issue was she a victim of anything, or was it a natural death? And I concede in that case. And sometimes if you change the hypothetical in cases, it helps you understand whether a decision was crazy or not crazy. That's what lawyers do, right? You change the facts a little bit. So I saw a lot of people, smart people who I like and respect, who trashed the judge on this victim thing. And my initial reaction was to kind of think that it was ludicrous. But I think if you think a little bit further, I still think it wouldn't have been my decision as a judge. And, you know, we had no problem saying victim, as we have mentioned, in the Southern District and in the Northern District of Alabama. But on the binary question of whether a decision is crazy or not crazy, I put that in the not crazy category.
Those were not my quibbles with this judge. And I think he made some serious missteps that were far more concerning to me.
Let's go to those. Tell us about those.
I mean, you know, he holds the ruling on this misdemeanor count that he ultimately dismisses before the case goes to the jury. The motion in regards to that count is made months in advance of trial, but he doesn't rule on it until the trial is almost over. I don't know how pushy the prosecution was for the ruling. Of course, that was only a misdemeanor charge, but it was a charge that it would have been very difficult for the defendant to get out from underneath had it gone to the jury. And the judge's interpretation of the statute was strained. He sort of interpreted an exception to this rule about juvenile possession of a firearm. He interprets an exception so it swallows the entire purpose of the rule. As a prosecutor, I would have liked to have had that ruling early so I could have appealed it pre-trial. And then we could have either included that count or not. I think the judge played games there. The jury instructions were a real problem. In a case like this, where you know it's big and there are sustained issues, this is really your only job as a judge in some ways. I mean, I watch my husband, my husband's a state court judge, even when he's trying a little fender bender, I'll see him up late at night for two or three nights working on jury instructions, even in a case where he knows the law extremely well. Here, this judge, his instructions were so dysfunctional that he was questioning himself while he was giving them. He had to start and stop to send the jury out. And something that you started this conversation about the judge by talking about is how judges influence juries. And they do. They, in essence, become leadership figures. Juries tend to really love judges for the most part when they're in their courtroom, and they look to them for guidance, especially on the law. His performance here was terrible. And my third quibble with him is this. As these small, petty criticisms mounted, whether they were merited or not, as a judge, you understand that one of your important roles is to ensure that people have confidence in the integrity of what's going on in your courtroom so that they can have faith in the outcome of the case. This judge didn't do that. He made no effort to clean up his behavior. You know, his phone goes off in the courtroom and plays the Trump theme song, and he makes a comment about lunch that some people believe has racial overtones. Instead of being much more careful about his conduct, he just really seemed to double down on not caring about his professionalism in the courtroom. And I think that was a mistake as well.
Yeah, look, the judge is the parallel of an umpire or a referee. And if the public is talking more about a referee or an umpire than about the players or about the game, and in the case of the trial, the facts or the evidence, then that's a problem. He should not have been the center of attention. He was also making comments about the media and what people were saying about his rulings. He seemed to be very, very focused on himself. He did this other strange thing, and then we'll move on to something else that I've never heard of, and I don't know what to make of it. But in Wisconsin, like in a lot of other places, you pick more jurors than you need in case someone has to be struck, in case someone gets ill, and you don't have to declare a mistrial. So you need 12 jurors to deliberate, but in that jurisdiction, you pick 18. And then finally, when the case is over and deliberations are about to begin, you have to let go 6 of the 18. And, you know, I'm 53 years old, been practicing law a long time, overseeing a lot of trials. In the federal system, often the extras are sort of known in advance and it doesn't go through this process. But in no circumstance have I ever seen a situation where it's the defendant on trial who does the random selection of those who will be excused. And that happened here.
So that was crazy, but it's also not legally significant, right? I mean, it doesn't really matter who's doing the picking as long as it's clear that there's no bias involved.
What was the process by which Rittenhouse was actually the agent who determined who would be excused?
He literally just pulls jury numbers. So they have a bowl with jury numbers, and Rittenhouse is the one who's pulling the numbers of the jurors who will be excused. Typically, you would expect to see the judge or the clerk be the one doing that. I thought what was really interesting here, though, was the judge's explanation for why he did this. He said he had had an earlier trial where black defendant, only one black juror, and the black juror had been excused, and he was concerned about the appearance. And I thought how lovely it was that there was one small facet of this trial where he was concerned about the appearance, but not about any of the much larger sort of issues raised by his conduct.
By the way, you know, people have asked the question, are there other charges that could be brought? Is there other liability? There have been some civil suits brought. People may remember from O.J. Simpson time that just because you get acquitted of a criminal state charge doesn't mean that there won't be civil cases brought that, again, plaintiffs may prevail on. I'm not aware of a civil case brought specifically against Kyle Rittenhouse yet. I think there's at least one or two cases that have been brought by victims. And I can say victims because this is a podcast, not a court of law. So don't sanction me, Joyce, Judge Vance.
No sanction.
Against the police. But, you know, presumably there could be civil cases against Kyle Rittenhouse. There is a criminal case, I believe, against the person who was the straw purchaser of the AR-15 that was given to the 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse. And then some people have raised the idea of a federal enforcement action against Kyle Rittenhouse. Do you think there's any chance of that?
I don't think there is. I don't see what the jurisdictional hook would be for the feds in doing this. So the comparison is Arbery, where there is a federal indictment. It's a federal civil rights indictment. And to do that, you have to prove some form of racial animus to make those charges stick. The Rittenhouse case is a very different one. And there's, you know, federal government's criminal jurisdiction is limited. It has to be based on you're in a federal location or you're killing an employee of the federal government. There are jurisdictional hooks like that. None of those exist in Rittenhouse. I don't expect to see federal charges.
By the way, you know, here's an issue that comes up in trials. You know, it's a very expensive prospect to defend yourself against criminal charges. And, you know, lots of defendants don't have the luxury of sophisticated counsel. What do you think was the dynamic here?
Kyle Rittenhouse, who sort of crowdfunded his defense and got a lot of donations that contributed to his ability to run the sort of defense that he ran, I think benefited very heavily from that funding. For one thing, he was well rehearsed. You saw this when he took the stand and testified. There was very careful choice of language. And he refused to let his conduct be characterized by the prosecution as offensive killing. He stuck to this line of, I simply did what I needed to do to protect myself in such a disciplined way that I thought it was difficult to imagine anything other than the fact that that had been drilled into him. And we learned a little bit more about that from his lawyer after the verdict, when the lawyer, I think, let slip, I don't know why he would have discussed this, but mentioned that they had been able to run not just one, but multiple mock juries, and that they used that process to decide whether it was a good idea for Rittenhouse to take the stand or not. They concluded, in the words of the defense lawyer, that he did significantly better when he took the stand. So here's the inequity of those who are financially capable in the criminal defense system at work.
You know, we ordinarily say that it's rare for a defendant to take the stand and that most of the time it's to that person's detriment, depending on the facts and circumstances and how much baggage they have and whether they have a criminal record or not that they can be cross-examined on. But in the case where the defense is self-defense, much more common for the person on trial to testify, to sort of, you know, convey to the jury the state of mind that they were in when they did the thing that they were accused of doing.
I think they almost have to take the stand. If they want the jury to credit that it was self-defense, the jury needs to hear it from them. It's really interesting that we saw Rittenhouse testify. We saw Travis McMichael, one of the defendants in the case that we're about to talk, take the witness stand and testify. It didn't go quite so well. And in another case that we haven't talked about for a few weeks, Elizabeth Holmes is on the witness stand in her own defense in the Theranos prosecution. So we'll be talking a lot more about defendants taking the witness stand.
So let's talk about the Ahmaud Arbery trial. As we're speaking on Tuesday morning, I think the summations have ended. I have my cable television station on, and the judge in this case, who I think has done a far better job than the Rittenhouse judge, is giving the instructions to the jury. Looks like he's doing so very somberly.
He really is the judge straight from central casting, right?
No,
I mean,
he's very
good.
I think
it's worth saying his courtroom control has been excellent and he hasn't tolerated any nonsense.
And you and I, before we started taping, were talking about one of the lead prosecutors in the case, Linda Dunikoski, who I think has also done a very good job. And one of the hallmarks that I was saying to you before of someone who's doing a very good job in argument is if you've been sort of paying attention to the trial, and I've been paying, you know, a good amount of attention to the trial, and then in summation, I'm hearing arguments that I hadn't thought of, and points where you're weaving together your theory of the case that make sense, and I'm hearing it in a new way, that's a sign that the prosecutor is doing a good job. Now, this case, you know, is partly a self-defense case, but I think they sort of abandoned that idea. Remember, there were these three men, father, son, and a third person, who basically, you know, cut off Ahmaud Arbery, who was jogging. They hadn't witnessed him commit any crime. They said they just wanted to talk to him. And before you know it, they've shot him to death, or one of the defendants has shot him to death. For most of the trial, most of the case, they have premised their defense on this idea that you have in Georgia of citizens' arrest, arrest by private persons. I'm just going to read this to you, and then why don't you explain why this works or doesn't work. And they basically said that this person, Ahmaud Arbery, was suspected of going into a house under construction, maybe had engaged in burglary, and that justified the actions they took that led to Ahmaud Arbery's death. But if you look at the statute in Georgia, it's very clear. It says, quote, a private person may arrest an offender if the offense, and this is the important part, is committed in his presence or within his immediate knowledge. And if the offense is a felony and the offender is escaping or attempting to escape, a private person may arrest him upon reasonable and probable grounds of suspicion, end quote. And much of the prosecutor's argument has been these men had no idea that a felony had or had not been committed by Ahmaud Arbery. What do you think?
So this is the now repealed Georgia citizens' arrest law that harkens back to recapturing escaped fugitive slaves. So many things wrong with the effort to use this as a defense, but I think you go right to the most important point, which is that even if you credit everything that they say, the case fails on the fact that not only did they didn't observe a crime taking place that would have justified a citizen's arrest, they had no basis for getting in their trucks and going after Arbery in the first place. There was just nothing there. And so in her rebuttal argument, the prosecutor does a great job of driving home that the McMichaels were actually on notice, that although Mr. Arbery had been inside of this, you know, home that's under construction, that's been the subject of this case, that they were aware that he had never been accused of taking anything, that the owner who had had videotape on had been watching people and calling in trespass claims. And something that really jumped out at me is one of the police officers who's involved testifies. And he had actually been looking for Mr. Arbery. He wanted to warn him to not go on the property again. Even the legitimate law enforcement officer involved in this matter wasn't planning on making an arrest, just a warning, hey, please don't trespass anymore.
Yeah, I think the prosecutor did a great job of elaborating on the argument that you put so succinctly. And that is, everything about what the three defendants on trial did in the moments surrounding the death of Ahmaud Arbery is consistent with their having no idea, no immediate knowledge, as the statute requires, that a felony had been committed. Because even by their own statements at the time and their own testimony, a couple of things. One, they never said in a long, wide-ranging debriefing with cops, no one ever said we were effecting a citizen's arrest. That's a post-facto legal defense that they're mounting in connection with this very serious trial. And it seems a little odd if their state of mind was, we're trying to effect a citizen's arrest, that you don't mention that and you don't plead that in the initial interview with the cops. And then the second thing that she pointed out very effectively is that their testimony is, you know, we pulled alongside him. We said, we want to talk to you. Hey, what's going on? All of that, she says, demonstrates uncertainty. That if they had, you know, clear knowledge that there had been a crime committed, they could have, you know, under their own logic, just gone up to him and just tried to arrest him, not inquire further. Which what they were doing was engaging in a further inquiry, which smacks of speculation and conjecture, not of immediate knowledge, personal observation of a crime. And I think that's really the center of the legal case, the narrow legal case. We can talk about the broader, you know, societal implications, as we did with the Rittenhouse case. But the whole criminal case and defense stands or falls on that point, right?
I think that's right. For this defense to have even a shot at working, they have to show that they're legitimately making a citizen's arrest, which, of course, you know, they don't even mention the day of the crime, which I think is game over right there. And they don't have the basis for making it. Game over there as well. But then they would have to use that to say, well, we were making a citizen's arrest, and suddenly this man fought back. You know, saying citizen's arrest is essential to negating the notion that they somehow provoked the incident and to establishing that they had a right to be there. And then they've still got to make out a self-defense argument, which is really rough for them to do. I think almost impossible here. I am reminded that just before I became a prosecutor, so, you know, mid-1980s, there was a case in Villarrica, Georgia, right on the Alabama border, where the police were making traffic stops and arresting people. And surprise, surprise, they were pulling over people who were black for pretextual reasons. And when that case got to the 11th Circuit, which was strongly critical of law enforcement in Georgia for their behavior, it was referred to as the crime of driving while black. I think that that's still what we're seeing in this case, right? This is the why is the black guy in our neighborhood case.
Yeah, and by the way, that's a good reminder of some other facts that are not necessarily, depending on how you think about it, and I'm curious how you think about it, legally relevant to the narrow question of guilt or innocence on the part of these folks, but is otherwise very telling. There is surveillance video footage of the owner of the incomplete house, the house under construction, that shows not just Ahmaud Arbery wandering in, but lots of other people wandering in, including a white couple, including white kids. None of them were chased. None of them were shot. None of them were lynched. So your point about why this has happened to the one black man who did what lots of other people have done and other people have done generally in the country, I've done. I've wandered into a house under construction. You know, it's not a capital offense. But this guy got shot because of it in part.
And he gets shot, and the prosecutor does a good job in her rebuttal argument of making the point that they knew that the owner had established that Mr. Arbery had not taken anything from the location. I mean, they definitively knew that, which seems to be the opposite of justification for making a citizen's arrest.
There's one other point that I think is worth talking about that I think has outraged a lot of people, and I think rightly so. Some things that outrage people, I don't necessarily agree with the outrage, but sometimes I do, and I wonder if you do. And it got a lot of attention. That's the defense lawyers, one or more of the defense lawyers at this trial complained about the presence of black clergy, specifically complaining about the presence of Al Sharpton. There was a reference to Jesse Jackson, smacks of racism. And the defense lawyer, I think, did it more than once.
Al Sharpton right now, that's fine, but then that's it. We don't want any more black pastors coming in here or other Jesse Jackson, whoever was in here earlier this week, sitting with the victim's family trying to influence a jury in this case.
Outrageous or not outrageous? I think it is.
I'm so outraged by so many aspects of this case. This notion that you can't have specifically black clergy in the courtroom is obviously racist and reprehensible. And the judge did the right thing here. But I think it's important for folks to understand the importance, especially in the Deep South, of the Black church in calling for racial justice, in supporting people who've been unfairly victimized, whether it's by the criminal justice system or other aspects of society. This seemed to me to be, as much as anything else, a dog whistle. I don't know if it's a dog whistle, if we can all hear it. I feel like we need a new word, like a dog megaphone or something. But this was a way, and this was Roddy Bryant's defense lawyer, I think, who raised this point at least twice, of saying, we don't want the activist Black church involved in this case. We don't want to hear any conversation about racism in this case. And this case is not to put too fine a point on it. You and I have both called it a lynching. I mean, it just is a lynching. I don't know any other way to characterize it. And the notion that the Black community shouldn't be outraged and supportive and that the family doesn't deserve clergy support is just so appalling in context in this case.
You agree that sometimes defense lawyers make a record and they make objections hoping that it will be an issue on appeal. That request to not have Black clergy was denied appropriately by the judge. You agree with me, and you're the appellate lawyer here. That is not any grounds for a legitimate appeal, correct?
That is no grounds for appeal.
You know what I was thinking about when I heard the lawyer make that request and complaint and objection? You have supporters of defendants in criminal cases all the time from whatever their community is and whatever their support group is. If you prosecute a cop in New York, you know what the courtroom is going to be filled with? 100 cops in uniform. I mean, I've seen it.
Absolutely. Every time you prosecute a
cop.
And
you know, yes. And you feel, and you know, there's no legal objection to be made. And in fairness, you're the prosecutor. You're like, yeah, this is you know, good for the defendant. And you can feel as a moral matter, you have 100 cops in the room and they're staring down the jury. It's not Black clergy, but there's the support group of the individual that's under trial in that circumstance. But it's an open public trial. It is what it is. It would never have occurred to any one of my assistant U.S. attorneys to complain about the presence of other cops in a case like that.
The defendant's insinuation here is the same as the predication for the crime that gets committed. Black people in the courtroom will intimidate the jury. They will frighten the jury. And that was what was really being insinuated here and was just so deeply offensive.
I'm actually surprised the defense lawyer didn't make a citizen's arrest of the Black clergy.
Honest to God.
So, Joyce, before we come to an end, the jury will have this case soon. This podcast will not be published for some hours. I don't think there'll be a verdict by the time people listen to this, but I guess there could be. I think you and I are both in agreement that the defendant should be convicted. Whether they will be is something that's always unknown, but I think high likelihood.
I do too. I worry about a hung jury here, frankly, because
well,
the arguments.
Worry about that.
But here the arguments that the defense was making, you know, they weren't arguing to the whole jury, right? They were just arguing to a juror or two that they've singled out. And I have repeatedly had the experience in cases where the evidence was clear, but there were civil rights overtones, where the defense can successfully find that one juror who will listen to their arguments and who will hang up the jury. But look, we're right on top of Thanksgiving.
Let's just talk about that for 1 second. We used to have a view, more when I was a young assistant U.S. attorney than when I was U.S. attorney, that and I think there's some evidence actually that I've seen since that bears this out, that the jurors and judges both are more merciful in the wake of holidays.
Christmas juries, right? I never wanted to indict a case that would get tried right before Christmas.
Now, there are two things at work here. This is not sort of, you know, specific black letter law that we're discussing here, but just from our experiences. The jury is getting this case the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. I always felt there were a disproportionate number of verdicts that came back on a Friday because people just want to get their stuff done and go back to their lives. And the prospect of a looming weekend sort of focused the brain. And here you have two things that are sort of at odds with each other. One, you know, what some psychologists think is more mercifulness in the wake of a holiday, the holiday season, Thanksgiving and Christmas is not that far away. But on the other hand, maybe they can do quick work of this and have this off their minds, off their plates, off their consciences before Thanksgiving and they can enjoy their Thanksgiving, which might militate in favor of a quicker verdict. What do you think prevails here?
So it's roughly 11:30 in Georgia right now. That looks like the jury will get this case soon. I bet he'll send them out to lunch, and then they'll come back and start their deliberations. And the charges are serious. There is a malice murder count. There are four felony murder counts. Juries aren't supposed to consider punishment, but they all know that these are essentially life in prison sorts of charges if they convict. So, you know, we could see a verdict before the podcast drops tonight, but I don't think so. I think that they'll talk this afternoon, go home and sleep on it, vote in the morning. I think this jury will want to be done tomorrow.
You heard it here, Judge Joyce Vance. We'll
see. I'm probably going to be totally wrong, right? They'll come back in 15 minutes and acquit.
By the way, I have been, for the first time in many years, called for jury duty.
Really? I would strike you in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be serving on any juries in a criminal case.
I don't think so either.
In Westchester, because, you know, among other things, our friend Mimi is the DA. So
Mimi Rocha.
I'm thinking I'm not going to get picked, but I would really like to serve on a jury, actually.
Mimi has just been named the seventh most influential person in Westchester County.
Oh.
And she texted me last night to tell me that her son wanted to know what she was doing wrong. Why wasn't she number one?
Yeah, of course.
So
that's what kids
you're
are for.
You're never a prophet in your own house.
That's true. So look, we'll be following the Arbery case. I'm sure we'll be talking about that next week. Maybe something will happen with the Texas abortion law, SB 8. But until then, have a great, great Thanksgiving, everyone. I hope you celebrate with family and friends, especially if you weren't able to do so last year. Stay safe. Eat a lot of food. Overeat, if that's your want. We'll be back next Tuesday. Send your questions to letters@cafe.com.
We'll do our best to answer them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, Chelsea Simmons, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Doss. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.